What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to a special week for the What Bitcoin Did podcast. I'm your host Peter McCormack, and this week I will be releasing six interviews relating to Mt. Gox. First up is an interview with the creator of Mt. Gox, Jeb McCaleb. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors, and I have a very special announcement to make first. I'm excited to announce that Kraken is now a sponsor and the official exchange of What Bitcoin Did. How cool is that? So listen, I get approached by exchanges all the time, and I don't really want to be advertising new exchanges every few months. It doesn't feel right that after you've maybe tried one exchange that I tell you to quickly jump to another. So I wanted to have one exchange, one which shares my values and one which I can work with to bring amazing content and ideas to you. And for me, as quite a heavy Bitcoiner, there was clearly one company and one CEO that was the obvious choice. So a month ago, I reached out to Jesse Powell. I told him my idea. I told him I was being approached by a bunch of exchanges and I didn't want this. I told him I just wanted to work with one. My preference would be that it was Kraken. And yeah, he liked the idea. So we met up, we had dinner, agreed terms. And here we are a month later, and Kraken are the official exchange of What Bitcoin Did. And I couldn't be happier about this. And not just that, when I told Jesse about the opportunity to interview Mark Karpeles out in Japan, and I was kind of umming and ahhing about whether to do it in person because, you know, there's quite a lot of cost associated with that. Jesse was just like, Pete, you got to do this. Give me your BTC address. I'll give you the money. Just go out there and do this. That's a measure of Jesse and a measure of the relationship I've had with him since we first met. And this is why Kraken were the obvious choice for me to have as a sponsor for What Bitcoin Did. So over the next few weeks and months, expect to hear a lot more about Kraken for me, why I think they are the number one exchange for Bitcoiners, and some of the cool projects we're going to be working on together. And let's not also forget about my other main sponsor, BlockFi. It is these sponsors that allow me to do it. So if you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender servicing customers worldwide, including 47 states, and their interest rates are now as low as 4.5%. Also, BlockFi accepts Bitcoin, Ether, or Litecoin as collateral. Customers can be funded in USD or GUSD, which is Gemini's dollar-backed stablecoin, and you can go from application to funding in as little as 30 minutes. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000, and applying takes less than 2 minutes. That is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, which is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. Okay, so on to my interview with Jed and the background to these interviews about Mt. Gox. So firstly, there was no plan originally to do this. I reached out to Mark Karpeles about a year ago when he did his Reddit AMA. He responded to me, but then we were never able to schedule something and make the interview happen. Fast forward a year and I'm in San Francisco and I have the chance to interview Jed McCaleb, which whilst I wanted to interview Jed, it wasn't done so with this plan for all these other interviews. It was only when I got back to the UK and the Mt. Gox story started to blow up again that I approached Mark and he agreed, and very quickly had all these other interviews stack up. So the Jed interview wasn't prepared in preparation for the other interviews, and given the chance I would do it again and probably have more questions, but still I think it's a nice way to start off this week of interviews. And on another note, sadly there are some sound issues with this. About halfway through the recording, my sound desk died on me and we had to record directly into the laptop, which isn't great. I'm really sorry. I've done my best to clean it up, but it's got this really annoying tinny sound. And yeah, you're just gonna have to suffer that and pay close attention to hit listen to it. So all the other interviews have been recorded at a much higher standard, but this one does have half of the interview with a kind of poor sound quality. So I'm very sorry about that, but I hope you can stick with it. If you do have any questions about the interview, feel free to reach out to me. You know, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And if you want to support the show, then there's a whole bunch of things you can do. That is all listed on my website. You head over to www.whatbitcoindid.com and click on the support section. It explains it there. I've got some lightning stuff coming soon, which is going to be cool. And I also want to thank my Patreon top tier sponsors. Firstly, make sure you check out vidyen.com, who create open source plugins which you can use to reward users with virtual items or store credit when they mine crypto in their browser or on your WordPress site. That is vidyen.com, which is vidyen.com, and honeyminer.com, who make mining and earning money simple for anyone with a computer. Okay, so onto the interview with Jed. Like I said, I'm sorry about the sound issues that happened halfway through. I hope you can bear with it. And if you have any questions, do feel free to reach out to me. Good afternoon, Jed. How are you?
Great. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Whenever I do an interview with somebody, I always ask them at the end who I should interview. And I met with Jesse, obviously a great guy. And he said, I should come and interview you. And obviously, I'll jump at the chance, but I really want to talk to you about a lot of the background. What I've been doing with a lot of my interviews is trying to, because I only became aware of Bitcoin properly in around 2016, there's this whole load of stuff I don't know about that I'm trying to piece together by meeting people. So it would really be good for me, because you're pretty much around pretty much from the start, right?
The start of it becoming popular, I'd say. Like, I think when I heard about Bitcoin with their first Slashdot article, which I think was in like summer of 2010. At that time, before the Slashdot article, I think Bitcoin Talk had like 200 people or something on it. After it had like 2,000. So I was in that first, that wave.
Right. See, I don't consider that when it became popular. I think almost like last year is when it became popular.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like the start of it's like, yeah, people coming, I guess. Yeah.
And you were already involved in software at the time.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I've been a programmer forever since I was a little kid. So I've been involved in the prior project was also kind of a distributed peer-to-peer system like eDonkey 2000, which is a file sharing thing similar to Napster or BitTorrent, something like that.
So. Yeah, I read about that. So what is it that grabbed you about Bitcoin?
I was pretty immediately taken to it. I just didn't really think it was possible to solve that problem before, to solve this double spin problem where you could have people that don't know each other still transact with it without a party in the middle. And I just thought that was super powerful and awesome. And got super interested in how it was done and like all the implications, and just kind of wanted to get involved essentially. So,
and now you work on Stellar.
Yep.
So I usually have a couple of questions I have at the start, just to try and get a picture for me of like someone's mindset. It's going to be quite interesting to ask you these, because a lot of my previous interviews have been with kind of maximalist people. But Right. What's your kind of take on the whole crypto space right now? Like your kind of summary of everything that's going on?
Let's see.
I know that's a lot to get into an answer.
I mean, there's obviously like a ton of stuff going on. I think the crypto space in general is just way overhyped. Like the amount of actual like use it has is like way lower than the amount of attention and money that's going into it. And I think that that's generally bad. I mean, some of that has been correcting over, I mean, this is, you know, 2018 has been kind of correcting the whole year. So like, I think that's been pretty positive. But in general, I mean, there's a lot of innovation, a lot of cool things, but there's just a lot of stuff that's not technically, that doesn't really have technical merit. And I think that's kind of unfortunate. There's a lot of misallocation of capital, I'd say. So.
Am I right? I read you say 90% is bullshit.
Yeah, somewhere around there. Yeah, somewhere around there. I don't know. Maybe that's high estimate. I don't really follow a lot of the other projects because there's just too much to like keep track of. But every time I kind of do a random sample, I'm like, this doesn't really make any sense. So
what things do you keep an eye on? What are the things you are interested in?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty focused on Stellar these days. I think what we're trying to do is make a sort of a universal payment network, like linking all the different currencies and financial networks together. Whereas like, I think Bitcoin is, I view it as more of just, here's a new kind of internet level currency that anyone can use. And is kind of like free from government coercion or something like that. I think that's kind of the driving force behind it. Whereas Stellar is a slightly different than that. So that's what I spend most of my time just trying to make Stellar a success.
But how do you feel about Bitcoin right now itself? Do you maintain an interest?
Yeah, I mean, I still think Bitcoin's great. I mean, it's not in the 90%. I would say it's in the 10% of the projects that are quality. So, I still own some Bitcoin, and like I still follow it to some degree. Like I think, I would be surprised in 100 years if Bitcoin wasn't still around, that kind of thing. So,
right. Okay. Yeah. And I don't intend to talk a lot about Stellar today because I think there's other juicy things to talk about. But what can you do with Stellar that you can't do, say, with Bitcoin?
So the main things are you can hold any kind of asset or token in it. So Stellar was designed to tokenize other things. So it's designed to basically bridge different networks. So you can put dollars in it, you can put euros in it, you can put bitcoins, and it's got a built-in exchange there. So it's got a built-in DEX, which they say now. So it's pretty funny because Stellar came out, probably 5 years ago, and, you know, it had this concept of a DEX in it. It had this concept of what is now stablecoins, which is now all the rage. But I mean, this is what kind of the vision we had been promoting for a long time. And now I feel like the crypto space is finally like getting it to some degree. So I don't know. It's kind of cool. Those are kind of the main differences is like, Stellar is in some way a superset of Bitcoin. Like it doesn't just have the native currency. It also has all these other kind of features that are, that are built around being able to move fiat currencies around the world and linking these different payment networks together. So,
right. Okay. I haven't paid a lot of attention to Stellar, not for any reason to have anything against it. I just am quite focused on Bitcoin myself. But the only thing I tend to hear about it is that, oh, it's just a copy of Ripple. So is that a huge myth?
Yeah, that's pretty much not accurate at this point. I mean, when we started, we used the Ripple code base, but pretty quickly we realized that we needed to kind of rewrite everything. And so, you know, we took a couple of years and did that. And so now the code is completely different. The visions are sort of the same, obviously, because I created both of them. So that makes sense. But the way we're approaching the problem is very different and the code is all different. So it's not really fair to say it's a copy of Ripple at this point. So.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, I really want to ask you about Mt. Gox.
Sure.
Do you know, one of the most interesting things I found out recently, I was in a different interview and somebody told me, they're like, do you know where the name came from? I was like, no, I've got no idea. And obviously they told me it came from that card trading game, Magic the Gathering. And again, that must be another thing that's missed me by, but apparently Magic the Gathering is still a huge thing.
Yeah, it's actually bigger than ever, I think. Yeah, which is crazy. But yeah, there's...
So you actually built a trading platform for that first?
I think when eDonkey kind of wound down, I was just kind of messing around and I decided to see kind of if people were still playing Magic. They had an online version. I just checked it out and I was like, this is cool, but there's no way to trade these cards online, not an easy way. And so I made this thing, Mt. Gox, or Magic the Gathering Online Exchange, and got that URL. But I only ran it for a little bit and then moved on to other things. And then I just reused that domain when eventually I learned about Bitcoin, because at that point Bitcoin was still so early, I didn't want to go think of another name or go buy one. I think people have a hard time contextualizing what it was like back then when you think of what Bitcoin is like now. I mean, it was just very unclear that Bitcoin would be a success at all, that anybody would ever care outside this small group of 2,000 people on this forum. So, so that's why it was just kind of, and the whole way I made Mt. Gox was just kind of on a lark almost, just because I wanted to learn more about how Bitcoin worked. And this is just a good way to learn about the system. So it wasn't like it was ever intending to be like this massive business or anything like this. So,
you didn't foresee having a large percentage of Bitcoin on the exchange. It was more just having a play.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I definitely didn't think that we would ever have a huge percentage of Bitcoin in the world on there. It was more just, yeah. I mean, I did think that the exchange would take off in that small community. I didn't know that small community would grow orders of magnitude over the next year or whatever, right? So all these factors just kind of happened. I mean, there was some other kind of almost peer-to-peer local Bitcoin style exchange at the time, but there's nothing like Mt. Gox where you could do actual kind of trading with people, the way that all the modern crypto exchanges are. So it was pretty clear to me that that would become the standard way people trade the stuff. But, that pool of people was only only 2,000 people. So it wasn't clear to me that that would become a big enterprise. So
Mt. Gox was the first proper trading platform then?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's quite a big endeavor to go under, right? What was kind of impetus to do it? And do you remember what the price of Bitcoin was when you started work on it? Could you even get an accurate price?
You couldn't really get an accurate price. People were just trading on the forum in random places. It first opened on Mt. Gox, I think around 6 cents or something like that. That's where the first trades were clearing. It was, it's a totally different world than now. So
how did you even plan to build an exchange? Did you look at other types of exchanges like stock trading or forex exchanges?
I've always kind of been interested in that stuff a little bit. So I had done some trading a little bit, as a hobby, I guess. But I was somewhat familiar with it. So, obviously I'd made this card trading site. Trading's pretty straightforward. There's not, you have bids and asks and they cross and then a trade is done, right? It's not rocket science, which is one of the reasons why I didn't want to keep running it, is because I usually like to work on things that are pretty, kind of more on the cutting edge of technology. So, it wasn't intellectually interesting to me. So
when you first started work on it, what were the kind of key challenges you did have to get over? What was the new things you were having to learn that you weren't expecting?
Honestly, the main challenge with exchanges then and still today is just getting fiat on and off the exchange. Like that's the, that's kind of like the roadblock for like how successful you can be and like how much money people can put through there. It's just all like how much fiat you can deposit and withdraw like that. That's by far the main challenge. And that's not a very fun one because you're dealing with like APIs of banks that are like old and crappy and like, and, you know, or just like random like integrations to different payment networks and stuff like that. It's just not very fun work.
How did Mt. Gox handle fiat from day one then?
We used PayPal, Liberty Reserve. I'm trying to think if there's another one. I think we would take bank wires. Yeah, I think those are the three ways.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I can never get a PayPal account again because of it.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, they banned me for life.
They banned you because of using it for the exchange or because of what happened later on?
No, using it for the exchange. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So how long did you get away with PayPal for?
We got away, it was probably like a couple months, 3 months maybe, something like that, 4 months. I don't know. It's for a while.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you think that's, what terms were you going against with that?
In what sense?
Like, what rules had you broken with PayPal?
Oh, with PayPal? I think you weren't allowed to use it. You weren't allowed to use it for, like, e-money. Like, there wasn't really this concept of digital currency back then, but for, like, e-money, like, things like, I don't know, whatever, that e-gold or Liberty Reserve, things like that, you couldn't use it for, I think.
So, right. Liberty Reserve was the one that was eventually closed down, right?
They eventually closed it down, yeah. I think the U.S. raided them or something. I don't know what exactly happened, but it's another thing sort of like e-gold, where it's basically like a centralized Bitcoin. Yeah. So, yeah.
Right, okay. So, you open up trading day one. What was the first day like?
I mean, it was mellow. It was, you know, I think I probably just made an announcement on the forum, the Bitcoin Talk forum, and, you know, a few people like started testing it out. You know, I think it was at that point, everyone would get pretty interested in all the new projects because there wasn't that many Bitcoin projects. So anytime you would build a site, people would come and like check it out and like poke it and things like that. So, I mean, I think people just started using it. I don't really remember anything that significant about it, but. Yeah, I mean, I was excited about it.
So. Yeah. Okay. So at what point did the volume start to get a bit serious? Like, did you have any one of these kind of spiky bull runs in that first year?
I only ran it for like less than maybe like 6 months or something like that. So like I didn't run it that long before I handed it over to Mark, unfortunately. But so I think there was... You know, it was just kind of starting to get interest, like more and more volume. Like it was growing the whole time that I ran it. I would never say it was like huge. I think when he took it over, I think it was only like 2,000, 3,000 people. So it was still pretty small. I think even at that time, it was only on pace to make like 100K a year or something like that. It really took off probably a couple months after he took it over. That's when Bitcoin went from, I don't know. I don't remember what it was, but it did this huge run up, I think, to 25 cents or something, which was huge then, right? Or maybe to $1 or something like that. But it was, I remember being pretty crazy.
Okay, so you run it for 6 months. And during that time, like, bearing in mind, like, I've been about 2 years heavily involved in Bitcoin. Yeah. And one of the things you first talked about is security straight away.
Right.
What was the kind of security back in kind of 2010? Were hacks happening? Were weird things happening?
There were definitely weird things happening. I can't remember. No, that was after. I mean, it wasn't anywhere near to the degree it is now where, you know, I think if you're going to run an exchange now, you really, really have to be on top of it. You know, I think again, like no one, there was just a small pool of people that even cared about this, you know, like 2,000, 3,000 people that even like cared about Bitcoin at all. So if anyone was to hack your site, it's from this group of people. So you definitely, you know, but at the same time, it does have a value on the internet. So people were like poking around at the site, like looking for, you know, you could see them try to like log in with lots of different things and things like that. You could see them kind of like probing the site. And there were a few, like, you know, we had an incident with some Liberty Reserve exploit that someone found, which was pretty annoying. Like they're, I don't know, whatever, it's probably too in the weeds, but their API was really, not well documented / well made, so it's like easy to do this exploit. But anyway, and what else? Yeah, I mean, there's like minor things. There was a lot of PayPal fraud. There's a ton. That's really the reason why PayPal shut it down, is because there was just too many chargebacks on PayPal, which I knew would happen, but mainly I just thought that it was worth it to have, again, the easy on-ramp for fiat. And then I was just going to cover the PayPal losses. So it's worth it. It's almost like, I don't know, like advertising in a way, like you just get people to be able to use it.
Okay.
It's more important than eliminating all fraud, basically. So,
And were you having to, what's like security part of your planning? Is there something you had to think a lot about, you had to build in at the time?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's a website, so you have to be somewhat conscious of security. I mean, another reason, a big part of the reason why I handed it off to Mark is because I realized that it's starting to take the amount of effort that you need to put into security was something I didn't really want to do. And I needed to either build a team to do it, or I needed to find somebody else to run it, because it was going beyond hobby scale at that point. So I thought about raising money to go build a team to do it, but I ultimately decided this isn't really the kind of business I would want to run. Again, it's not as intellectually challenging as I would like. But I didn't want it to go away, because I thought it really benefited the Bitcoin ecosystem. And I think it did, until the ultimate catastrophe, but it really introduced a lot of, it was the really, cause when I first started Bitcoin, it was very hard to get actual Bitcoin. Unless you ran a miner, there really wasn't a very good way other than messing around on the forum, right? So Mt. Gox just provided this much easier way to get onboarded, right? So it's actually pretty beneficial to the ecosystem, I think. But yeah, it was clear that security, there was increasing attention on the site, and security was becoming more of an issue, and we needed more people to look at that. And that's one of the reasons why I handed off to Mark. So,
I mean, I guess you probably didn't foresee a 20K Bitcoin, and it was still just, I think people don't realize that back then a lot of people didn't think it would succeed or last.
Right? Oh yeah. I mean, definitely not in the time frame that it had, or to the degree, I think people were, so yeah, I think what happened is when I gave it to Mark, I think it was trading at 25 cents, a few months later, it went to a dollar. And at that point, people were ecstatic because it reached parity with the dollar. We never thought it would even do that, right? Mm-hmm. So that was this huge pinnacle, right? And so obviously that's nothing compared to what it's done since then, right? So it's just a totally different mindset. So
okay, so you make the decision you don't want to run it anymore. Does Mark approach you? Do you approach Mark? How does that relationship come about?
So I had asked him to do one of these bank integrations. I had met him on IRC or something. The community was pretty small back then, so there wasn't that many. There wasn't a big pool of people to choose from, and he was, he purported himself to be this awesome programmer, and I had him do this integration with a bank in Europe, so people could deposit euros and whatnot. I think he was running some other hosting business, so it kind of seemed like he kind of maybe knew what he was doing. And I just had him take it over. So,
and how does a handover like that happen?
So yeah, I mean, it was kind of done in kind of stages. I don't remember how exactly it went down, but I gave him part of it first. I think he early on got access to the actual server. He didn't get so that implied access to the hot wallet of Bitcoins. The cold wallet, I didn't hand over to him until sometime later, and the actual domain, not until later still. So just kind of slowly transitioned this stuff as I got more comfortable with it.
But, right. Yeah. And did he buy it from you?
Well, I don't know. Essentially he bought it from me. I mean, for future revenue, but yeah. Right. Yeah.
Did you ever see that future revenue?
Yeah. I mean, he did. Yeah. He did eventually pay me some. I mean, not as much as I think he should have paid me. It's again, too much in the weeds.
The site had lost some money, and I was expecting him to cover that too, which is one of the reasons why it was essentially free. But although not free, it's kind of, because he had he bought it with that debt, and plus he had to pay me some money in the future. Obviously in retrospect, it was quite cheap for him, but again, nobody knew what Bitcoin would be doing at that point, and it was very hard to predict. So,
Was it a smooth handover, and did you get on with him during the process, or
The handover itself was fine. I mean, that was fine. I mean, the problem started to happen. There was some hack onto Mt. Gox, I think 4 months later or something like that, and that's when it became very clear to me that Mark didn't know what he was doing. And basically, the site was hacked. It was he had to like shut down the whole thing. It was shut down, I think, for like a week. And like everyone was like freaking out because it was the only place to trade Bitcoin at that time. Like tons of people had their money there. This is actually like, this is before I met Jesse and Roger. They both flew over to Japan to try to help him. I remember them, they told me some story about how, you know, the site was down, and then it was Friday and the site was down. They said, okay, hey, what time are we showing up tomorrow? Like, you know, get this going or whatever. And Mark was like, oh, it's the weekend. I'm not coming. And they're like, what? And like, everybody's freaking out. There's literally just nothing on, if you go to mountbox.com and like people's money stuck there. Like just stuff like that. Like he just does not have the right mentality to run this kind of thing, which is fine. But he should be aware of that and like try to get the right people, which was what I was trying to encourage him over the years. Which was like, it's like, Mark, you need to get someone that actually knows how to run a company or sell this or do something. Like get somebody in that can like help you out because this isn't your strong suit, right? And he just does not listen. So yes.
So you maintain some kind of relationship for quite some time.
Relationship is a strong word.
Communication.
I would send him emails being like, hey, you know, every once in a while, and these became less frequent as I kind of realized it doesn't even matter because it's an email, but that was like the first time there's an incident. So like I tried to give him advice and help him out. And he just kind of wasn't listening to anything I said. And then later on, as the site was kind of like doing its thing and like, you know, like Mt. Gox has had a stream of problems since like he took it over. And like, you know, I would try to, again, like say this kind of stuff, like, hey, you really need to get somebody else in here to help you. But he just doesn't, it's like stuck into a wall.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, that's very frustrating.
Did you hold any responsibility? Is there any parts where you self-reflect and think there are things that you did that may have contributed to it?
I mean, I definitely could have found someone other than Mark to take it over. I think that's like the number one thing. But I had zero control over what he was doing after he took it over, and so there wasn't that much way I could have influenced how things went down. Like ultimately the way the ultimate disaster there was surprising even to me, like as much as to everyone else, that he basically had this cold wallet that was drained over a couple of years and he lost like 600,000 Bitcoin. Like that is like insane that he was just never checking this cold wallet to have the accurate balance. Like that's like mind blowing to me. Like I never expected it to die in that way. I thought that he would run into the ground just because he's incompetent, but like he would do, like he was renting the most expensive office in Tokyo or something like that. It, like he just does like crazy stuff, right? So I thought that's what kind of would break down the site, is that it would just run out of money and like one of these others would just take over. But the fact that he actually just lost all the Bitcoins is like crazy.
Next up, I talked to Jed more about Mt. Gox and his thoughts on the hack, but before that, I have a message from my show sponsor, BlockFi. And listen, it's been 6 months since BlockFi started sponsoring the podcast, and they've had a great contribution to everything I've done. Together, we've built up a really strong relationship, and their business just goes from strength to strength. I'm hoping to head out to New York in a few weeks to catch up with them and discuss some ideas about some new product launches which are coming, but right now, I thought it'd be a good time to reflect on why I'm such a big fan of BlockFi. While 2018 has not been a great year for traders and a number of businesses have struggled or closed, I think it's been really great for finding the companies that are creating value, the crypto companies which are building the foundations for the future of Bitcoin. For me, BlockFi is one of a limited number of companies doing this. They have a product which merges the crypto and non-crypto world where you can use your digital currency for loans, which for crypto holders is a much easier way of getting a loan than from with a bank. I love the plans that BlockFi has for the future, and anything which gives more power to the customer is something I am a huge fan of. So listen, if you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender, servicing customers worldwide, including 47 states, and their interest rates start as low as 4.5%. Also, BlockFi accepts Bitcoin, Ether, or Litecoin as collateral. Customers can be funded in USD or GUSD, which is Gemini's dollar-backed stablecoin, and you can go from application to funding in as little as 30 minutes. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000, and applying takes less than 2 minutes. So you know the drill. Check them out at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, which is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid.
When did you first hear about the hack?
Which one?
The major hack.
The fact.
The big. The thing that brought it all down. Obviously, it was over a period of time with the the cold wallet, but there were a few incidents together, right?
So the big one was, so basically I think that he stopped Bitcoin withdrawals and then it came out that the Bitcoins weren't even there. I heard about it with everybody else. Like at that point, like, you know, he'd been running it on his own for like 4 years or something like that. I was barely ever talking to him at that point.
Right.
So,
okay.
I mean, I even had money on that box when that happened.
You had some there as well. It's funny, in doing this, everybody I meet has some on there.
Yeah, but that's the crazy part. It's like, I don't know why people are still keeping money there, but even I want to sell it.
Yeah, I guess. So the hack happens, obviously. For someone like myself, who, Mt. Gox has this kind of shadow over Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
But when you come in, there's like so much you don't know. Like I can't still fully appreciate what that was like at the time, but a lot of people talk about that could have been the end of Bitcoin.
Yeah, people say that. I never got that feeling, right? It's like, it was very clear that this was just an exchange and like obviously a very big one and an important one, but it never seemed like an existential threat to me that whatever happened at Mt. Gox a real threat to Bitcoin. I mean, it would have maybe some dampening effect, but like, you know, ultimately it wouldn't really matter. And I think that's what's happened. It ultimately hasn't mattered. Like, that's kind of the cool thing about Bitcoin. You can just kind of wrap around all these things. Like, you know, it's the whole thing about Bitcoin is you shouldn't be trusting the central third party, right? So, you know, it is what it is.
What do you make of the whole rehabilitation process?
I haven't really been following that closely, honestly, but it's funny that it's, or not funny, but it's cool that it's like that the Bitcoin that they do have is now has enough money to like pay everyone back in dollar terms, I guess. But so I think that's that's good for all the people that actually did have money there. So
you'll do a payback.
I guess I haven't filed the claim.
And did you see the Kim Nielsen report? The WISAC?
Oh, the WISAC thing? I think I read the one after when it was like detailing how all the coins were lost over years or whatever. Yeah.
Did you rate the report? Did you think it was good? Did you agree with it?
I have no basis to agree or disagree. Like, it just seemed like he was this analysis of how these coins moved around or whatever, and the fact that, like, all this money was being taken over years. It was definitely interesting.
Because that's the only thing I found, like, it makes a kind of a claim against you in there, right?
He does have some stuff in the beginning that is just definitely wrong, how I was, like, using customer funds or whatever, like, trade or something like this. I think, I don't know if that's in that one or some other stuff that he said, but that's definitely not true.
Yeah, and one I've read, he said it was insolvent at the point you handed it over.
Well, I don't know what his definition of insolvent is, but, like, it wasn't insolvent. I mean, there was somebody running it that had funds to like, keep it alive and, like, pay people if they needed to. Like, that's not insolvent. Right?
So. No, I guess the point was more that it was possibly operating a fractional reserve at that point because it didn't have all the Bitcoins for all the customer
funds. Yeah, but that's just, like, I mean, I don't know. That doesn't seem like, given the scale of the thing, like, basically when he took it over, it was short maybe, like, I think $50,000 or something like that. It was on pace to make $100,000. It was, like, 2 months later, it was on pace to make, like, $1 million. Like, that amount of loss just is totally irrelevant to the actual business. And, like, that's, like, normal operating for any kind of startup. Like, you're always operating. Like, that's not a big deal. Like, you don't expect to be break even like in day one, right? So I don't know. It shouldn't have been impactful to the Mt. Gox business, is what I mean. Or anybody's ability to get the big one back.
No, I understand losses. I've run businesses. Yeah. I've run businesses into the ground and I've lost businesses. I've been through it all. But the 50,000 loss, that's the first I've heard of that. So, you know, I'm thinking on the top of my head, but is that 50,000 in loss? Say, is that because there was Bitcoin that were missing? So that added up to
a certain amount. When I gave it to him, there was no Bitcoin missing. There was just a Liberty Reserve that was missing. I think that was around $50,000. Shortly after he took it over, there was a hack where someone stole some Bitcoin, and that's probably what the WISAC guy is talking about. But even that was just, I think it was like $30,000, something like that, somewhere around there. So.
Yeah, the WISAC thing said there was a hot wallet stolen, but that happened while you were still in control.
But he's wrong. I wasn't still in control. We both had control. It was during the handover. So it was basically shortly after I gave Mark access to the box that Malcolm was running at, running on.
Right. So it was like that period where you were during the handover.
Right. But I had already but the site already belonged to him. Like I already sold it to him.
You'd already sold it to him, but you said it handed over in three parts.
So basically we came to an agreement and I think it was around very early February. Then we started handing over the site and there was a 2 week period where we both had access to the box. So I could show him what was going on and all those kind of things. The actual site where the box was running. And during that time is when the someone broke in and stole the coins. So that kind of is what it is. But again, it wasn't, it sounds like a lot now because it was a lot of Bitcoins, but it wasn't a lot back then. I mean, it wasn't, it was $30,000 or something like that. Right?
So, 80,000 Bitcoin.
I think was about $30,000 then. Or maybe even less than 25 or something,
so what happens at that point? That's down at March 1st, 2011. So that's in that period. You realized or Mark realized?
Who realized that the coins were gone?
Yeah.
I think I was the first to realize, but yeah.
So what did you ever find out where that hack, how that hack happened?
I didn't, but he may have, I don't know.
Yeah. So what kind of discussions are you two having at that point?
I mean, it was more just about hey, what do we do now? We need to obviously move the site somewhere else because this machine has been compromised and, get it somewhere that we can lock down again. How do we make up this loss? Things like that. So, I mean, the easiest thing to do was that the site is making fees on all these trades. Mm-hmm. It could easily cover this loss in a few months. Let's just divert that revenue rather than to the Mt.Gox bank account, but back into what's held in reserve, right? So
that's what you two agreed.
Well, that's what I advised him to do. Again, he's running the site. I can't tell him what to do anymore.
Because I guess what happened, I'm just piecing the pieces together there, because you said then shortly after you sold it, it went on a big run.
It did, yeah.
So if 80,000 Bitcoin are missing at
$30,000
value and the price goes up 10x, then 300,000 is missing.
Well, so it was, the big run was to $1. So it went to so then the loss became 80,000 or something like that. So.
Yeah, because then I guess then that's the start of a fractional reserve. Bitcoin, right?
That run also made a bunch of fees. I don't know how much he made in the fees in that. I mean, he should have made $80,000 in fees in that as well, right?
Yeah.
So
if it's 80,000, I guess we would have to know the price it started at and went to and what he's doing with the fees and where he's putting the fees. But also, fees aren't Bitcoin.
Half of the fees were Bitcoin, half were dollars. So what I advised him to do was, obviously put the Bitcoin fees in there and then take the dollars and sell them for Bitcoin to cover the Bitcoin loss.
Right. Okay.
So that's what I advised him to do. And I think that's the whole Goxbot thing that has somehow become nefarious when really what it's doing is it's taking the fees, the money that Mt.Gox has owned and converting it either to dollars or Bitcoin, depending on what Mark needs. Right. So.
Another thing he has in here is that there was a public hack via compromised accounts and the hacker gained access to your admin account.
That's right, yeah.
What happened there?
I think there was some exploit in the forgot password form or something like that where they were able to get it and then they got my account, which had admin rights, which could add balances to accounts, and they used that to add a bunch of balance to one of their accounts.
See, the one thing that's interesting is if you go through it, they're kind of totaling up the losses as you go, because then you've got the, is it pronounced Bitermat? Well, Bitermat debts. So some debt. So that's, at that point, it's 102,000 Bitcoin, $50,000. And then.
But see, that was some exchange that Mark bought, right?
Oh yeah, of course. I'm not attributing it to anyone.
Why do that? Why buy that thing if you're not able financially to buy it? You know what I mean? That was a decision of his to do it.
Yeah. But, I mean, possibly he was out of his depth. The thing is about this, I guess when you reflect back, with the knowledge that Bitcoin is now worth $20,000.
Right, right.
Yeah, or has been at $20,000, it's now worth $3,500.
Right.
And you're not taking in consideration it was 20 cents or 25 cents or whatever. But I'm just trying to picture in my head what's going on. Do you know what almost feels like? Have you watched that Fire Festival documentary?
I haven't watched that. I haven't.
Oh, you've got to watch it. It almost feels like a similar scenario when something just keeps getting out of hand. Because there's another one here. There's a compromised database in September 2011, another 77,500 Bitcoin taken, and then a hot wallet was stolen again in October, and that was 630,000 Bitcoin. So it seemed to be like a thing that just got further and further.
Right.
He got more and more out of his depth.
Yeah.
When did you last talk to Mark?
It's been years. I mean, I've only talked to him on Skype a couple of times.
Right.
Okay. Over voice. It's probably about 2011, maybe 2012 was the last time.
Because I read a thing about it that, because the way the rehabilitation was done, people were going to be paid back in dollars.
Right.
And he could end up becoming a billionaire out of this. Did you read about this?
I heard that. Yeah, that would be pretty unfortunate. So,
I think, yeah, it's probably a bit more than unfortunate. Yeah. Probably, do you think there's a better way of handling it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, that's definitely not the way it should go down. I mean, I don't think that's in the cards now just because Bitcoin has come down a lot. But, yeah, that would just be kind of a, I don't know, travesty of justice, I guess, if he ended up walking away with that much money. So.
Do you 100% trust him?
Mark?
Yeah.
No, I don't trust him at all. Yeah.
And I guess there's two types of trust here. There's whether he tells the truth and whether he's just incompetent. You can trust somebody as a human but know they're incompetent, or you can also not trust them because they're a liar.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know Mark super well. Like, I you know, you probably know him as well as I do, honestly. Like,
I don't know him at all.
Like, I've only talked to him a couple times on Skype and a little bit on, like, IRC and stuff, right? So, So I don't trust him, his competence at all. And I don't really trust him not to lie, but I don't really have that much information. It's just kind of like the vibe I'm getting from what's happened. And like, it just seems shady in some degree.
You have lawsuits against yourself, right?
Yeah, sure.
Are they still ongoing?
There's one ongoing.
What is that? Can you talk to me about that?
I really don't want to talk about
that. You don't want to talk about that. Can I, rather than ask the details about it, but it relates to Matt Cox, right?
Yeah, but I really don't want to talk about this at all. This whole like, what my Matt Cox lawsuit situation is.
Okay. Well, we can skip that. Okay, give me a second to this bit. Okay, so, like, what's your kind of, like, whole, like, the summary of your feelings about the whole Matt Cox thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little complicated. I mean, I think it was an interesting thing to do, and I really do think it really benefited the Bitcoin ecosystem at the time. I mean, but it's really, really frustrating the way it shook out and like the way what it became. I mean, that run by anyone competent, it could have become like easy, like a $1 billion business, right? It could have maintained like it had like 80% of the liquidity at the time, and it could have maintained that position for a long time because liquidity kind of begets liquidity, right? So it's like, it was this huge cash cow, and then it just all kind of fell apart. And obviously, part of that was just like very painful for a lot of people, which is like super tragic. Like, none of that had to happen, and I think that stuff is really bothers me. And then also, it just has this ongoing like people like drag me into that. I think kind of pretty unfairly that like they blame me for a lot of the problems there. Like, even Mark has tried to put this on my shoulders, being like, "Well, the site was short, like, you know." You know, like $50,000 when it started, so therefore I lost 600,000 Bitcoin. It just doesn't even make sense, right? To like that is not why the site died. Like, that's nothing to do with it. It's totally irrelevant, right? So having to kind of like constantly fight that like PR battle or something is a little bit irritating to me. But I don't know. It is what it is. I think in general, I don't dwell that much in the past, so like I don't worry about it too much, but. You know, it is just, it's a little tragic how it went down. It could have had a much better outcome than what it did for me and everyone else.
So there must have been some quite stressful times for you with it as well, though.
Well, that's the frustrating thing. It was frustrating for sure. It's like super, super frustrating, but it wasn't necessarily stressful because there was no way that I could affect the situation. So when I would see Mark making a decision that it was just like clearly wrong, there's no way I could step in and do it. Like, to the extent I would try, he would just ignore my email or, you know, not really respond to me. So, I basically had to just ignore it because it was.
Say the handover had been 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
Could that hot wallet still have been compromised?
Maybe. I don't know how that they got, I don't know how that they got access to it. The timing is a little weird, but you know, I mean, again, like, I don't think that compromise, that particular compromise is really material to the outcome of Malkoff. I mean, it is some amount of money, but like again, the site could, was easily making that much revenue and could have covered it, right? So, it sounds like a lot now, but ultimately, like back then, it was just not a big deal.
It's more like a big chain of events, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it seems like the fundamental thing is this compromise that I didn't know about until the WiseTech article, and I don't think anyone did, where somebody was like slowly draining his cold wallet over years, like literally over the course of 2 years. I think someone was stole 600,000 Bitcoin from him. Like that is the nail in the coffin. Like, that's the thing that took down that cost, not these other like smaller things, right? And I think the smaller things are indicative of the security story there, but they're not the things that actually led to its downfall.
And we still have exchange hacks today. I mean, Cryptopia been hacked twice in a month.
Yeah.
Are you still amazed that exchanges get hacked, or do you think it's just an issue that will always exist?
No, I'm not. I mean, it's a hard problem. I mean, it's like Bitcoin is like the ultimate thing to hack, right? Like that's or someone holding Bitcoin is the ultimate thing to hack. Like that's it's a prime target, right? Like I'm almost surprised it doesn't have more, to be honest. You know, so I mean, these exchanges are holding like really a lot of money. So and it's something that they can easily someone even that works at exchange can move away. Like,
you know. A couple of things to finish on. You've been in the crypto industry for 10 years, right?
Yeah, something like that.
About that. So you've seen a lot. You've probably pretty much seen more than anyone else, right? You've seen First Exchange. You've been involved in Ripple. You've been involved in Stellar, a lot of things. What do you think is the most important things that need to happen to take the crypto industry forward in a positive way?
Yeah. So, I mean, the most important thing is this stuff really has to be start being used by real people for real things. I mean, it's still, you know, yeah, it's been 10 plus years now and still there's just not really good use cases, not really people really using this in the real world. And that's almost 100% what we're focused on at Stellar and Interstellar. Like we're trying to make it real. Like, you know, this, it's like I said in the beginning, like it, like crypto kind of suffers from its own hype and that just leads people to kind of like make all these like BS claims and BS projects just to raise a bunch of money and just like take it and run basically. And, you know, this can only last for so long and until, you know, people stop believing it essentially. But yeah, like it's just super important that we find a way, like we as like a collective industry find a way that this stuff is used in real life, right? So, and I think we're getting closer, but it's taken much longer than I think anyone has wanted it to take. So.
Do you have any sympathy with the more maximalist view of things that it's very difficult to create lots of different coins and people don't want to have lots of different coins and lots of different tokens? It doesn't make sense for user experience and it doesn't make sense in monetary terms.
I wouldn't call it maximalist. I just think most, like again, like this goes back to my earlier comment, like 90% of these things are garbage. It's because you don't need a specific form of value to like buy if you have something that wants to buy like pet food, you don't need a pet food coin. Like you can use Bitcoin, you can use dollars, you can use like these kind of standard currencies. You don't need like a specific currency for this one use case. It doesn't make any sense. In fact, it defies what is good about a currency that you can use it in multiple places. It's just barter at that point, right? So, and a lot of projects are along those lines. And I think I definitely agree with that point. I don't think that there should just be Bitcoin or just be Ethereum or, you know, I think there'll be lots of these things. They're all kind of solving like different use cases and they fill different niches in the world. Just like there's not one kind of database, there's lots of different kinds, right? There are one kind of programming language. You need multiple to solve different problems. I think that there will be, one standard one that's solving each of these problems, but there are lots of problems, basically.
What is the problem that is Lumens a token?
Yeah, we call the token Lumens.
Yeah, what is the problem that solves?
So, I mean, well, the Stellar network in general solves this problem of making moving money around work a lot more like email, where you can have, you can have your account at a bank and you want to send it to someone's mobile money wallet and you can just go seamlessly. We don't really have to think about where people are storing their money or what currency they're using. All these things just become interoperable, right? So it's just a way to, again, just bring payments into the internet age, right? And so that's what Stellar solves and Lumen is a piece of that.
Okay. And did I see about $120 million of Lumens being given away?
So, yeah, we announced something with blockchain.com.
Dot info.
Well, they have both.
Oh, is it both? Yeah. Right, okay.
But, yeah. So, we're doing a big distribution with those guys. Yeah.
What do you... So I wasn't aware until you announced that there's a lot of people who have quite big criticisms of blockchain.com.
I don't know.
Really?
Do they? I don't know.
Well, you're not aware of any of their bad press?
Not really, yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's surprising. So, why give away $120 million? Like, who should be claiming that? Does that potentially risk a dump on the price on Stellar because people just take it and then sell it?
Well, I mean, the thought is that if you do it thoughtfully, right, then what you're really doing is increasing awareness of the network, and like you're getting in the hands of a lot of people that could potentially become users of the thing. And it's sort of, it's similar to the way PayPal grew a little bit earlier where they would give out $10. It's like a way to get people to try your system and start using it. If you do it in such a way that you're actually gaining more adoption, then you're increasing the supply, then it shouldn't. But I mean, really the purpose is to get, to make Stellar this usable, system. And to do that, it needs to be in the hands of lots and lots of people. So our main driver for this whole thing is to do just that, is to get it in the hands of millions of people. And then they can start building stuff. They can start transacting with each other. They can start actually using the currency. And again, to make these things real. Like, I think that's what we need to focus on more than the price. If the price is sort of secondary. In my view, like the main goal is to make the network useful.
I put a tweet out the other day where I said, I kind of feel like most of these projects now, in hindsight, and most of these tokens would be probably better as a stable coin because the volatility isn't really helpful to anyone.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it depends on what you want to do with the thing, but yeah.
Yeah. All right. So before we close out, just a couple more questions. How do people keep an eye on what you're doing? How do people stay in touch? And what are your kind of closing comments about Stellar that people should be aware of?
Sure. Yeah. If you go to the website, stellar.org, you can sign up for the newsletter. That's probably the best way to stay informed. You can join our Reddit, rStellar. A lot of good activity there. We're super excited about 2019. There's a lot of projects in the works. We're growing the team a lot. We're working a lot on scalability, working on this project called Starlight, which is kind of our payments channel, our version of Lightning, essentially, that will interoperate with the rest of the payment channel efforts out there in the world, and also bring that kind of technology to Stellar itself. It should be pretty cool. What else is happening? Lots of cool things.
Have you reserved the seat on Richard Branson's? Galactic?
Is it just go up into space and come back? I'm only interested to go to another planet. So like, it's right, got okay. when he has that going, I'll sign up. I need some sort of generation ship or something, not just a quick.
Have you never been tempted to be one of these people who pays to go up on the International Space Station?
That would be kind of cool, but again, like it's not as enticing as like going to see a whole new world. So
did you watch First Man?
I did, yeah.
I assume you saw it in the cinema, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the moment where, I don't know about you, but that moment where they're on the planet, I thought was on the moon, was pretty epic.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Kind of
blew
my mind.
Yeah, yeah. First Man was a pretty great movie. Yeah.
I think it was, for me, it's probably the best film of the year.
Really? Yeah, I think it's just amazing how much mileage the United States got out of doing that. Like, I feel like it's like gave them so much like social capital in the world for years because they were the first to do that. Like, I don't know, it's pretty cool.
Actually. Yeah. Well, listen, thanks for your time. It's great to meet you. It's great to hear about some of the history, and hopefully get to meet you again sometime.
Yeah, thanks for talking.
Okay, so what did you make of that? What did you make of Jed? I gotta say, whilst I'm not a fan of Stellar and I haven't really spent much time looking at it, it was great to catch up with Jed and talk about the early days of Mt. Gox and get an understanding from him of why he created it, why he handed it over to Mark, and some of his thoughts about the various hacks. Jed himself has also got a lot of flack in relation to Mt. Gox, but we have to kind of remember that Bitcoin was trading at about 6 cents when he first launched it. And within 6 months, he handed it over. I guess he had no idea of what's to come for either Bitcoin or the exchange. In hindsight, it was kind of beneficial to have st down with Jed and talked about Mt. Gox and Mark in preparation for my interview with Mark that I didn't even know was coming. So yeah, I'm glad I did it. In hindsight, I would have had some different questions, but you know, I had no idea how this was all going to play out. As ever, thank you to anyone who supports the show, whatever you do, whether you're just a listener who shares it out with your friends, or whether you've left me a review on iTunes, or whether you're a sponsor. Everything you do to contribute to the show helps me to keep this going. And if you do want to support the show, there's a whole bunch of things you can do. So firstly, make sure you listen to the sponsors. They're the people who really make this happen for me. Without them, I don't have a show. And if you don't want to listen to the sponsors, then you can subscribe to an ad-free version on Patreon, which is patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. For $5, you get the show early without any ads. If you don't want to use Patreon, you can pay in crypto, drop me an email, I'll give you an address, and I can add you to the distribution list. I've also actually just set up a tipping.me account, and somebody's actually paid me in Lightning, which is super cool. So if you want to do that, then give me a shout, we can make that happen. If you want to become a show sponsor, I haven't got many slots left now, but if you are interested, do feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Downloads are growing like crazy. January is a record month. February is going to be another record month. You can leave me a review on iTunes, or you can click on the subscribe button. That helps with my ranking. And you can follow me on social media. I'm on Medium. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. I'm at WhatBitcoinDid on everything. And my personal Twitter is at Peter McCormack. You can check out my website, which is www.whatbitcoindid.com, and sign up to my newsletter. And you can share this out with your friends and family. Tomorrow, I'll be releasing my interview with Mark Coppelis, which was also video. So keep an eye out for that. And remember, if you do have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.